You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is the 23rd of March, 2022, and this is Matthew Raphael Johnson. I appreciate everyone for listening. Of course, I'm going to talk more about Ukraine. If you've been paying attention, last week I've had so many interviews and appearances and lectures that, you know, I am exhausted. And the people who interview me tend to be pretty smart. And they are often very talented. They know just what to ask me. And because they realize that in certain situations I'm verbose. And so they let me talk at length. And I think that's part of the attraction. And now, as always, I always ask for your financial assistance. Radio Albion has everything you need on my page, where to donate and how, and of course where to buy books and where to subscribe to Patreon for me. And I appreciate all of that, and many of you have been very generous, and I appreciate it. Up until now, I've done the particulars of the war, something that I've been talking about since I started this life, that's been brewing for a long time. But thanks to a few articles from Alexander Dugin this month, and well, especially March of 2022, I want to use him, as I've done before, as a springboard into a few other things. Some of you know that the word geopolitics has two specific uses. The first is in the academic sense. You know, geopolitics is shorthand for international relations in general. So, you know, the politics of not so much geography, but simply international conflict. But there's a more specific definition, which we use a capital G, and it's something that Dugin himself subscribes to. I find it to be less intuitive than he does, and it's not something taught in academic departments of political science anymore. And that's the term geopolitics as it was coined by Halford Mackinder, going back to really the turn of the century. And let me quote from Dugin here on this topic. Really just a few weeks ago, he put this out. Mackinder formulated the theory of the Great Continental War, the opposition between the civilization of the sea and the West in general, the British Empire more narrowly, and the civilization of the land, the heartland, Russia, Eurasia, somewhat earlier in 1904 in his famous work, The Geographic Pivot of History. Land, Rome and Sparta, for example, and the sea, Carthage and Athens on the other side, represented two antagonistic civilizations, opposite in everything, traditional and modern, spiritual and materialistic, military and commercial. The conflict between them is a constant in world history. And that comes from Dugin last week. Now, there's a specific, and then there's a broad concept of Mackinder's idea. And one that I've been preaching for a long time, of course, is a distinction between the land and the sea. These are civilizations, these are nations, that, given their geographic location, are forced to concern more with overland routes versus those that are dedicated more to the sea trade. And there's some truth to this. That I can vouch for, and this is something that, again, isn't taught in academia. I mean, it still exists to a great extent. But on continental Europe and in Russia, and I'm sure China, this is something that gets talked about pretty regularly. So I'll say off the bat that the geopolitical approach, and that's with the capital G, that pits the land and the sea powers against one another as a historical constant, is useful. It's extremely broad, but it's useful. Another way of putting it is that smaller nations and civilizations, places like Japan, the eastern seaboard of the U.S., Britain, are small in size and are, you know, have huge coastlines and are dependent up until recently on the sea trade. But because of that, science and materialistic ideologies and individualism become almost a necessity. This is kind of why Great Britain, which is a tiny little dot on the map, became for a very long time the dominant civilization in the world almost. It's because they use, and I've said this before, in the Great Spanish Armada, pitted the ultimate battle there between the land and the sea power. Or I should say, one of the most significant battles in global history, one of the things that ushered modernity into being what it became. Most of you know what the phrase "the great game" means. And the great game was, in one definition, the demand and the drive of the sea power, specifically Britain, to keep the land powers from taking over Central Asia. And that's where it becomes very interesting. The great game makes a lot of sense when you use the distinction between the land and the sea. Now, the Eurasianist movement, which Dugin is the best-known supporter, and, of course, the Eurasianists do support the geopolitical idea, that the real war, great game, roughly the turn of the century, was the land and the sea, the land represented by Russia and the sea, Great Britain. And because of that, having completely different ideological and economic interests, put in a very general sense, the sea powers are liberal. They need scientific development, you know, Darwinism, or some variation of it, to be applied to their day-to-day life to justify or even support any kind of expansion. Land powers don't need this, and therefore tend to be more authoritarian and traditionalist. So the real war was really between Russia and Britain. At the same time, Prussia and Russia seemed to be natural allies. And I've said this a thousand times. But World War I, for example, was the perfidy of the British sea power trying to get the land powers to fight one another. I have several articles on this topic. I developed it when I was working on at the Barnes Review, and to some extent in opposition to Harry Elmer Barnes, that World War I is largely the fault of Britain using Austria to get the two great land powers to slaughter each other. Britain was incredibly threatened and outperformed by the combination of Prussia and Russia together. Their economic drive was greater even than the British, and their growth was even greater than the British. They can barely handle one of them, let alone both together, especially after German unification. So the only way that they were going to survive, that the sea power was going to develop, is to try to get them somehow to fight one another. And that's exactly what happened. Using the actions, both the Turkish Empire, which they controlled up to a point, and Austria, to fight as the powder keg in the Balkans, was a way to get Russia and Prussia to fight one another, or I should say just Russia and Germany to fight one another. That was the purpose of the First World War. And it changed everything. And it led to a regime where the sea power became absolutely dominant and an entrenched economic liberalism as official doctrine. Now, this geopolitical model continues to make sense. And Dugin's point in writing recently has been to apply that to the war in Ukraine. A war, yes, that's almost entirely a media invention, but it certainly is a real war. Now, Halford Mackinder and his follower, Alexander Dugin, divides the world in a few different ways. There is, you know, Eurasia, the way we define the term, is the heartland, and that's with a capital H, of the planet. It's a zone, extremely significant, that connects Central Europe to the Far East. It comprises much of Central Asia. And in a broad sense, this is also the zone that is the central part of the new Belt and Road project, one of the most significant developments of our era. This is an enormous infrastructure program of the land-based powers seeking to take power away from the sea-based powers. This is an illiberal alternative system using this heartland, this center, as a way to connect essentially Central Europe to China and Russia, to a great extent, the steppe, and south of that in Central Asia. Given that it's a land power idea, there is war declared against it by both Washington and London, which shouldn't surprise anybody. So Mackinder's theory, around the turn of the century, the world can be divided again in three ways. The first is the largest. He calls this the World Island. This is an enormous entity comprising Central Europe, Asia, parts of Africa. This Afro-Eurasian heartland. Not the heartland itself, but this is this huge, where the overwhelming majority of the world's people and resources can be found. The heartland is a smaller aspect of this. Heartland is at the central core of the world island. Yeah, roughly to the Volga, from the Volga to China, and then north and south, from the Arctic Circle to even, you know, the Himalayas or the upper reaches of the subcontinent. Now, the heartland has traditionally been the stomping ground of old Russia. Not entirely, of course, but they are the dominant power, shared slightly with the Chinese. This is the heartland of the world. It's the heartland of tradition. It is the dominant area of the planet. There are anomalies, though. The islands and the sea powers. And that would include Japan and Britain, and even farther, North America. They are geographically and ideologically far apart from the world island. So in 1919, Mackinder writes a slogan. I think many of you may have heard of it. In a book called Democratic Ideals in Reality. And it goes like this. Whoever rules Eastern Europe commands the heartland. Who rules the heartland commands the world island. And who rules the world island commands the world. And it's a tremendously sweeping, maybe too sweeping, of a statement. That in these terms, I never found intuitive. It didn't ring true to me. But I understand there is truth to it, especially today. So the world island is the center of the globe. It's the center of the globe's resources. The core of civilization going back to the ancient world. But in order to gain that and gain control over it, which is extremely difficult, the heartland was essential. And again, the heartland is essentially Russia. And, you know, most of Central Asia. It does have a Slavic core. And this is, in the broadest possible sense, the reason why Russia and the Slavs have been hated by the sea powers for a long time. And this is what the Great Game, the 19th century, was all about. The Allies were, to a great extent, the sea powers, or at least heavily influenced by them. The Allies fighting Russia to at least keep them from full control over the heartland. It doesn't take much to see why it was so important for Britain to control India, and why it was so important to challenge Russia at its far south, including Afghanistan, and why the British, for a century and a half, if not more, financed and dominated the Turkic tribes of the Caucasus, the Chechens and the rest. It's more than just about oil. There's a historical, ideological, and then there's also almost a spiritual reason for this. That's what the Great Game was essentially about. Keeping Russia from expanding to such an extent that the heartland was theirs and theirs alone. Now, on the other hand, Mackinder tended to argue that control of the heartland was extremely difficult. It costs a lot in blood and treasure to maintain because of its sheer size and diversity. The very concept of empire as such could be found here, and this is the eternal, perpetual threat to Russia's enemies on the outskirts of this area. The sea powers were not quite able to penetrate the Arctic, the mountains to the south, the Urals, so war is almost a perpetual part of life in this part of the world, which is why Afghanistan over the years has become so enormously important, and why the geopolitical orientation of India and Pakistan is so extremely important. Ukraine fits into this Western plan to control the region. When I say the West or the Allies, I'm talking about the organized sea power. Now, France has always been, had half in one side, half in the other, but for a very long time has served the interest of the sea power, probably without being a sea power itself. Spain has always been the land power in the area. So the sea, in all senses of that term, you know, we talk about the ideological side of that idea. Liberalism is the core. Free trade, tremendous impetus for shipping, and the necessity of the application of modern materialistic science onto things like shipbuilding. I've mentioned before, the Spanish Armada is incredibly significant. I can't stress that enough. And it was a pure confrontation between the two sides. You know, the Spanish galleon was essentially a floating castle. It was the way that the land power approached the sea. Now, Spain had a far-flung empire, but the British applied science, individualism, atomism, etc., to its shipbuilding program to the point that they created a faster moving ship and better cannon. So what they lacked in unity, what they lacked in people, what they lacked in size, they made up for in technology. And technology has been the core of everything sea, etc., sea for a very long time now. And this is why it's important for some form of liberalism and free trade to inform what we call the sea power, powers that are dependent on the sea and sea trade. The land is the opposite. Land powers tend to be authoritarian and traditionalist. This is in Russia, Germany, Spain, to a great extent France. This is not an enormous surprise to people. Remember, this is a very broad theory. Of course, you're going to have all kinds of problems at the margins. Every theory in the world does. But at least it is interesting and does explain a certain number of things. Central Asia, Afghanistan, and now Ukraine fit into this model. Now, Dugin, you know, I disagree with him on several important areas, one of which is the notion that the Bolsheviks continued the Russian role as a defender of the land power. I don't believe this. The continuity, allegedly, between the USSR and Russia is one of the worst errors you could possibly make. They're opposites. Russia was banned and assaulted under the Bolsheviks, as with every other nation, well, except for one. The Bolsheviks did not represent the land power, but Dugin will argue that they were forced into that mode, given who their enemies were, alleged enemies were. And we know one of the great theses of my career is that the Cold War is largely overdrawn. The Western powers may have fought the Soviet Union when it got too large, but also traded with it and assisted it and educated its people for decades. But it doesn't matter. The conclusion remains the same. But even then, Ukraine and Finland, for example, were important battlegrounds for the war against Russia, no matter who was controlling it. Let me quote Dugin here again. In his position as High Commissioner for the Entente, Mackinder tried to put theory into practice. The Russian Civil War gave the sea civilization a new chance to push the borders of the Rimland to the east at the expense of territories leaving Russian power, which would include Finland, Poland, and most importantly, Ukraine. Part of the, and that's end quote there, part of the Eurasian idea is that even under the Marxists, and this is very controversial, and I'm not putting my signature on it, but enough of old Russia existed under the Bolshevik domination to, enough existed, enough remained to push the Soviet ruling class towards an ethnically Russian historical idea. Now again, that is very difficult to defend, but I understand where that comes from. The Eurasianist concept in right after the Civil War was that, okay, this Bolshevik elite is a tiny alien group of people. Pretty soon, as they're either purged or they leave or they, you know, they'll be overwhelmed, old Russia will reassert itself whether they want it or not. And as far as Russian history is concerned, that's a major thesis of the Eurasianists and one that I, for the most part, reject. To a great extent, this is how the white forces and Russian nationalists who remained behind in the USSR after they lost, that's how they rationalized their defeat. Or maybe it won't be so bad. Now, as I've said 100 times, it's true that the Allies only saw the Soviet Union as a problem when it sought to expand. I mean, how big can we let another empire get? It doesn't matter what principles the empire was based on. It got too big. And no matter, it could be, you know, based on Manchesterian economics, it doesn't matter. The expansion of the Soviet Union, especially when China fell, threatened to push the dollar or the pound aside. But we also have to remember, the West saw enough of the kindred spirit in the Bolsheviks to refuse to assist the whites. The whites were doomed for this reason. I have proof after proof after proof, and thank God for Anthony Sutton, that the whites were, the Allies were vehemently opposed to what the whites were, to the extent we know what the whites were, ideologically speaking. So the concept of the land, with capital L, the land is a technical term, land-based powers, it is general, as Eurasianism is this meta-theory, in essence. A good way to put it is that this is it's a set of parameters for political analysis. Put it like that. But of course, it makes sense that the sea powers, led by Britain and the Eastern Syndicate of the U.S., wanted to separate Central Asia and Ukraine from old Russia. This is a geopolitical constant. There's not much we can do about that. We can go back to the latter part of the Renaissance, where the Italian city-states, Genoa, Venice, Florence, again, classic archetypal sea powers, were financing the Turkic tribes to the far Russian south, including slave-trading ones, to evade and attack the southern Russian nation, to break their control over the heartland is essential. This is one of the things that makes the sea power what it is. So this is a constant. So separating Central Asia, Ukraine, and to a lesser extent Finland, from Russian power has been an obsession for centuries. As the Soviet Union collapsed in the late 80s, in the very early 90s, it seemed that this had been finally accomplished. You remember all of these small states declaring independence that most people, including most scholars, never heard of before. I was a teenager when this happened. I hadn't heard of them before. Now, you have a place like Ukraine, you have a place like Georgia, and even some of the Central Asian states. They're small, both in their economic output or their population or their influence. One way or another, they're small. And small states struggle with actual, real independence. I spoke about this in my Irish Civil War lecture last month or 2 months ago. For a country like Ireland to declare independence is difficult. Because are they really dependent? I mean, Ukraine certainly cannot be. It's not a self-sufficient nation. I remember this same thing happened with Kosovo. As laughable as that was, they're never going to be independent. Or the British can use that slogan. NATO can use that slogan. But they know as well as we do that it's just a matter of who are they going to be dependent on. To whom are they going to be independent? I should say. They're going to change one dependency for another. Let me quote Dugin one more time. Ukraine played a major role in Mackinder's geopolitical picture. This territory, together with Poland and Eastern European states, formed part of the sanitary cordon, a strategic zone that should be under the direct control of England and France, the Entente allies at the time, and prevent any kind of rapprochement between Russia and Germany. Being held back by this sanitary cordon, Russia, Eurasia, could not become a full-fledged empire. Without Ukraine, Russia is not an empire at all. And besides all this, Ukraine, hostile to Russia and under the direct control of the Anglo-Saxons, would cut Russia off from continental Europe, where Germany, in turn, was a heartland, and not only a global one like Russia, but a local European one. England's conflict with Germany, and formerly with Austria, was a constant in European geopolitics. And we've talked about this, I've talked about this from the day I started all of this stuff. Now, the reverse of that, I think, is fairly clear. In other words, a strong Russian Empire is the ultimate nightmare for the Seas ruling class, the Sea Powers ruling class, the Entente, the liberal powers of the West, the Outer Islands. Now, as you may have read in my book, Ukrainian Nationalism, an independent Ukraine by itself, in and of itself, is not necessarily offensive. No more than Finland's is, or Belarus. It's rather who is sponsoring it. That matters. The sea powers rule largely by deceit because they lack numbers. They lack sheer size. But this level of deviousness has served them very well. London has always seen Ukraine as a weak point, an entryway to either Russia or the USSR. And again, bringing back the white issue, became a problem when the white forces seeking aid from the Entente refused to budge. And I said this 1,000 times when it came to the notion of the Russian Empire as unitary. The white forces, and there are no exceptions to this, unless you want to consider Skoropadze a member of the White Army, which to some extent, I mean, he was on the fringes of it. He financed the White Army. He, of course, had a slightly different view, a much more different view. He was a ruler of the only competent ruler of independent Ukraine for God knows how long. But you can't go to the Allies, who needed to detach Ukraine from Russia, and ask for money and support to fight the Reds, and not give them what they want. And this is one of many reasons, but it was an important reason, geopolitically speaking, why they did not receive a bullet or a dollar or a pound, contrary to all the myths you may have heard, from the Allies. They refuse to consider even a little bit of autonomy for the country. Now, I'm going to argue, of course, that aid would not have come to the White Army regardless, for a whole bunch of reasons, but that is certainly one of them. The West, then or now, did not see the USSR as a threat unless it got too large, unless it, along with China, was going to take full control over that heartland and place it on an illiberal footing. The difference is, of course, there was never any sanctions on the Soviet Union or Communist China, for that matter, no matter how many people they murdered. Only with someone like Vladimir Putin is that going to change. And we all know that. I've said that about a billion times now. One of the reasons I always put the Bolsheviks vaguely in the same category as some of the CPOW is their basis, their adroitness in propaganda and deceit. Propaganda is inherently a bad thing. Technically, it's not. You could have good propaganda. But the way we seem to use it, it's a negative term. It is identical with dishonest rhetoric. Telling people one thing because they want to hear it, and all the while doing what you want. And Dugin has said this, I've said this, a lot of people have said this. It's hard to imagine, but in the early days after the Civil War, the Russian Civil War ended, Lenin was promoting a nationalist Ukraine within the Soviet Union, and they began to promote the Ukrainian language and everything else they could. But, and of course, as Stalin was to say later, we know that that was a story. That was propaganda in the normal sense of the term. There wasn't any honesty to this. It became clear pretty quickly that the Ukrainian peasantry wanted absolutely nothing to do with the Soviet Union. All of a sudden, of course, that project of this, you know, autonomous Ukraine fell to pieces. So once the peasantry was liquidated, it became more tolerable. It became more serviceable. It took decades of starvation and persecution to finally stem the anti-Soviet tide, of course, with the full backing of the US and the UK. Only when they were slaughtered in huge numbers, then it was okay to be Ukrainian. And I have so much work done in the Soviet era about how Ukrainian communists functioned. The difference between the Communist Party of Ukraine and the Ukrainian Communist Party. Two very, very different concepts. Now again, I want to point to Ukrainian nationalism, my book on the topic, because this gets very complicated. It's true that Ukraine as it stands right this minute, you know, its legal, so-called legal boundaries, are from the Soviet era. It didn't exist with these boundaries ever before. Now, Western Ukraine certainly has a claim to independence coming from the old empire of Galicia. It does have a claim to a separate history. And it has a history where Russia only played an indirect role in its development. That is defensible, and that is very real. The Ukrainian nationalists and historians around the turn of the century were correct to say you can't jump from Kiev to Suzdal to Moscow. No, there's another step, and that step is the Empire of Galicia, which is very large and wealthy in the Middle Ages. That could be the actual heart of independent Ukraine. But of course, given the Soviet era, that changed everything, and it brought together many ethnic groups and regions that traditionally didn't have a whole lot to do with one another. The Soviets were well aware that the Allies were not going to resist anything they did after the Civil War and after World War II, and so the Soviets had every intention of swallowing the entire Ukrainian world in one bite. So, as Dugin mentions, Ukraine was granted a huge territory once it was subjugated, if and only if it was broken. Now, before its peasantry and intelligentsia were destroyed, it was a class enemy, as nonsensical as that is. But after the genocide, it became useful. And that is the foundation of modern Ukraine, which is certainly no fault of the Ukrainian nation as such. You know, I've always been very sympathetic to Ukraine. But Dugin remarks, and correctly, that Donbass and places like Chernigov were not part of the old Ukrainian state. Regardless of that, Ukraine within those boundaries, post-World War II boundaries, was an integral part of the Soviet Empire. They even had their own seat at the UN after the war. Of course, it was a legal fiction. It was not an independent country, but it certainly acted like it was one. It was a legal fiction, and it hardly bothered the Allies anyway. And this is why Dugin says, and I'm quoting here, the Bolsheviks both created Ukraine and abolished it as an independent state. But really, you know, only the alien mentality of Soviet communism could ever create this trick. It's political stage magic, is one way to put it, where you could actually create and abolish an independent state at the same time. When you have a controlled press in the West and in the USSR, it may be it's slightly easier to do. So this is what Lenin put together, and this is the problem with Ukrainian politics to this day. Core regions, like the old territory of the Galician Empire, as well as a classic Cossack Hetmanate, that's defensible. But then Kiev, Chernigov, regions later on that were taken from the old and decrepit Polish Empire, Zaporozhye, Odessa, right to the banks of the Dnieper, I should say both banks of the Dnieper, and the Donbass itself. In 1954, Khrushchev adds Crimea. The problem here is that you've now created a rather strange civic nation, not an ethnic group. And of course, after the war, Galicia, neighboring regions were brought into the USSR, and that's why you have the artificiality of the modern Ukrainian state. This is not to say that Ukrainian is not a separate ethnic group to some extent. It's not to say that at all. It's just to say that given the Soviet manipulation of the area, especially after World War II, its creation of Ukraine from, you know, Galicia all the way to the Donbass is absolutely artificial, and that is at the root of why there's such a problem today. But the Soviets had expanded to such an extent, even Eastern Germany became part of the Warsaw Pact. One of the biggest disappointments, as you read history of the 20th century, you know, war was declared on Germany because of its invasion of Poland, apparently not noticing that the Soviet Union invaded from the east and the south at the same time. Stalin was actually worried. You know, what is the West going to do? I mean, we're going to take Bulgaria, but we're also going to take Poland. We're going to take even a chunk of Germany. Now they left Finland alone because Finland was not a threat. But the Allies said nothing when Moscow took Western-leaning states like Poland. No one said a word. And yet today, Russia is attacked and assaulted in every way for doing nothing except protecting its exposed flank, protecting its more vulnerable areas like the Donbass. And politics today there, politics is reduced to the reason why that is. Stalin was shocked that the West ignored the annexation of Czechoslovakia and Poland. And yet the Crimea, very Russian, traditionally very loyal to Russia, even after a referendum, is a problem. This is it. You know, the West yawned when Poland was swallowed into the Warsaw Pact, which is always a Western-leaning country, a Catholic country. Yet Crimea, unquestionably a part of Russia, is a cause for war and violence. So suddenly, imperialism, when it was done under Stalinist and Marxist auspices, was perfectly okay, but today, even in areas that are Russian, it's a problem. And it certainly wasn't called imperialism at the time, except in conservative circles. And not only that, it was okay in the Stalinist era, but the West was financially assisting them in the West was a integral part of rebuilding the USSR after both wars. And as sympathetic as I am to the old Cossack Hetmanate and the Empire of Galicia, the civic nation of Ukraine, created over a period of decades by the Soviet Union, can't stand. It is too deeply divided. Too many Russians live within these borders. Eastern Ukraine is an obvious case, but the Russian speakers are everywhere. I mean, everyone in Kyiv speaks Russian to a great extent. Of course, the central regions and you know, a whole bunch of authors talking about that, the old Cossack Hetmanate, the lands of the old Cossack Hetmanate, there is a legitimate Ukrainian core there. The old Ukrainian dialects were common. But to the west, the Dnieper, you know, like in Vinnytsia, you have the Orthodox agrarian idea predominating then and now. Not to mention that that was the stronghold of the Uniates, the so-called Ukrainian Catholics, this very strange combination of Orthodoxy and certain elements of the Roman Catholic Church that, by the way, have never been formally described or delineated. I was a Uniate for a while, many, many, many years ago. And I have fond memories there. I learned a lot from them. But I noted that there was no such thing as a Uniate catechism because there is no theological idea of the Uniate. Sometimes they're Catholic, sometimes they're Orthodox. They pick and choose. And I've been to dozens of parishes where they pick and choose whatever they want, wherever they want to be, whether it be from the Syrian, the Antioch, or Ukraine. Galicia, of course, has its own history. Its population was not directly connected with the Russian Empire for a long period of time. Not to say that this should be a part of Poland or Carpathia Rus should be a part of Hungary. That's ridiculous. They were enemies. But Russia really has no claim there. And because the Soviet Union was at war with all forms of nationalism, it didn't make any difference. The ethnic stuff, any of the Marxist ideas that ethnicity is going to fade away once the economic prospects and realities of these regions equalize. Now, of course, they were dead wrong about that. Galicia, Volhynia, had a almost unknown history of independence. They were independent from the rest of Ukraine for quite a while. The great Western princedoms maintained a separate existence based on the salt trade. And they cut their teeth, maintaining their independence against both Poland and Hungary and, of course, the Turks. The Galician kingdom was this was on the road from, you know, northern Europe to Constantinople and the Middle East. This is where they made their money. This is why they were so strong for a long time under Danilo and Roman. Not to mention the fact that you have some Rusyns and the Carpathians that were under Hungary, violently under Hungary for a very long time, and they only came into the USSR after 1945, some of them anyway. They never quite made their peace with the Soviet Union, but remain pro-Russian. You know, Russia could be criticized for maintaining their hold on Ukraine in the Soviet era, but Ukraine, of course, can be criticized for its hold on certain parts of Carpathia. Again, the West only concerned itself with the Cold War, in the way we know the term, when the USSR expanded at the West's expense. It irritates the heck out of me when I hear people talk about the new Cold War. No. No, the Cold War did not go down this way. It did not develop this way. NATO is the armed wing of the sea powers ruling class. It is armed liberalism. In my book on the West military failures in the Islamic world, I go into this. I have a whole chapter on the ideology of NATO from their own documents. NATO exists, and this wasn't necessarily the case during the Cold War, but it certainly exists now. NATO exists to enforce liberal ideology through threats of violence. The Soviets, or any power, could not be permitted to take any more territory in Europe, but certainly warfare was never going to be the result, unlike now. NATO existed for deterrence, which apparently was sufficient. The West signed arms limitation treaty after limitation treaty after limitation treaty, and only when Putin takes over, all of these get junked. All of a sudden, nuclear weapons are okay, and a nuclear war now is suddenly winnable, and yet it was unthinkable to say something like that in the 80s. Let me quote Dugin one more time here. Mackinder's map corresponded perfectly to the balance of power in the Cold War, and the two camps, communist capitalists, were strictly aligned with the land and the sea. The Eastern Bloc was a land, with the USSR at its center as the heartland. The Western Bloc was a sea, centered in the Atlantic, the Anglo-Saxons, but included the post-war strategic colonies of the U.S., the countries of Europe, Japan, and other third world states that proclaimed some allegiance to capitalism. Now, I think it's overdrawn. I think it's exaggerated. Remember, the Enlightenment, that historical and ideological era, was one of the developments of the sea power. You know, the Netherlands, in Northern Europe, and Britain. Marx saw himself as the culmination of the Enlightenment. He saw Marxism as the end of history and said so. But Western capitalism said the exact same thing about itself. So I submit that the Soviet Union was a land power, quote-unquote, only by geography, not ideology. In some cases, it took that role only because of the sea power being its occasional enemy. East and West during that period of time, capitalism and communism are motivated by the exact same set of values. Atheism, globalism, technology, economism, the reduction of everything to scientific slogans, and both ideologies came from the Enlightenment and assumed its basic axioms. I know there's many places I've gone through the similarities of communism and capitalism to the point where there really aren't a whole lot of differences, contrary to the myth. And of course, Japan is always, Japan, of course, is a sea power, but its ideological development doesn't seem to be that way. I mean, it was a member of the Axis, of course. Japan is not an archetypal sea power, unlike Britain. However, it's true that China is absolutely an archetypal land power. You know, just as much as Russia is, which explains, to some extent, the broad parameters of their being an alliance right now. So, sea powers develop, and the sea civilization develops because it requires science and high-tech sectors to make up for its numbers. The land powers tend to be much larger and more populated. Again, the sea came into its own, not just with the, you know, places like Carthage, the Phoenician colony, the Italian maritime republics, but also, of course, the rise of Britain, the Spanish Armada, and in the Renaissance. Science was able to defeat bulk, size, numbers, and nothing has changed, which is why technology in places like, you know, much of the U.S. and Britain and in Northern Europe, up until recently, has been the byword for success. How many times on this show have I talked about how important it is that the Western liberal powers need proxies? They always need ways to compensate for the lack of any kind of national togetherness. You know, technology, proxies, deceit, propaganda, science, something like that, for better or for worse. The Cold War was not a battle for the heartland for the same reason that the USSR was not really a land power. The Soviet Union, of course, was an alien anomaly. It was imposed through violence on a classic land power, but that's as far as I'm willing to go. And this is why so much violence nonstop was required to maintain the revolutionary state, to maintain the Soviet Union. And the violence couldn't really let up until they ran out of resources. Land and sea today are a matter of ideology. And I'm willing to say that while Russia is a classic land power, the Soviet Union was a land power only by accident. Let me quote Dugin one more time. As the Soviet Union began to weaken, Atlanticists is another word for the sea power. Atlanticist geopoliticians, like Brzezinski or Gilpin, began to think and act more avant-garde. In addition to the bipolar model and partial shifting of the balance along the world periphery and along the contours of Eurasia, they began to build more daring concepts of a unipolar world. Thus, Mackinder's ideas regained their freshness and relevance. To achieve the decisive and final victory of the sea civilization, it was necessary to break up the Warsaw Bloc, then preferably the USSR, and then what was left of it. In other words, to significantly advance Rimland to the depths of the sea, depths of the land, restraining it and blocking its access to the warm seas, where Russia was constantly trying to reach. This is what led, and now I'm talking here, that's an end quote, 1990s genocide against Russia and Ukraine with the collapse of their communist powers. That genocide, that starvation, that utter destruction of these civilizations, I mean, no one's sad to see the Soviet Union go. The problem was that it left a vacuum. The Chinese and the Belarusians were able to escape this. But those like Brzezinski supported the attacks on the USSR, not due to ideology, but due to the fact that suddenly the Allied ruling class began to see the Soviet Union in the 60s, 70s as reactionary. Without its former ideological sloganeering, you saw an exodus of its Jewish element to the West and to Israel. So then the old left neocons, or the old left, which became the neocons, began to be more brazen in its anti-Soviet posturing. It wasn't really anti-Soviet. One of the central aspects of the neocons is that they use Soviet and Russia simultaneously, and they use it synonymously. It was an anti-Russian, as much as it was an anti-Soviet agenda. It was an anti-Soviet agenda, it was an anti-Russian one. And that was the secret that kind of unraveled around the early 90s. In the mind of the sea power, the fall of the Soviet Union, and they wanted the fall of Peking, but that didn't happen, that would mean the opening of huge markets that now can be rapidly colonized and brought under the rule of the dollar. All the ridiculousness of the Soviet state, they did keep the dollar at bay. Vladimir Putin, Alexander Lukashenko, they finally put an end to this. This is why, not only are they popular, why they were successful, but why there is a war going on right now. Like I say, you have these attempts at compensation. And one of the things that the West was doing to compensate for its failures, starting around 2000, things like backing Islamic extremism, anything, you know, cyber warfare, anything that could be thrown at an actual Russian rather than Soviet policy. And Yugoslavia was their test case, as we all know. Dugin writes, Brzezinski and Kissinger made efforts back in the early 80s to finally break China away from the USSR, seeking to sink it into their global economy and integrate it into the sea empire. There you have a tremendous amount of truth. That is absolutely the case. So roughly between 89 and 92, when the destruction of the Eastern Bloc began, you started finally. I mean, you didn't have anti-Russian sentiment during the Cold War so much. You had some conservatives doing that. But not until the breakdown of the Warsaw Pact did you have this recreation of the old Crimea War anti-Russian sentiment. Again, anti-Russia, anti-Soviet, in the mind of the neocon movement, in the mind of the ruling class, was now exposed as one and the same. You know, Dugin makes it clear, Gorbachev was a servant of the sea power, even more than Lenin was. That's what began this concern with NATO expanding into countries that had no capacity, you know, militarily speaking, to integrate themselves into that bloc. I've gone through this, you know, the European Union, the same thing. Romania and Bulgaria did not have a shred of economic virtue that would allow them to be brought into the EU, but they were brought in anyway. And what justified it was the classic end of history nonsense. And this explains China's crackdown on the Western-backed dissidents, which crescendoed into the mythic Tiananmen Square massacre. That was a propaganda coup for the West. There was no such massacre. And I've gone through that at great length. So, again, the concept is to be independent, especially in the 90s, was inherently to be anti-Russian. It meant the opposite of independence, since it meant the total colonization of the old republics by corporate capital and the liberalism that it cannot function without. This is why the West invented the color revolution ploy and supported every single anti-Russian or Chinese group it could invent and that it could lay its hands on, whether it had legitimate complaints or not. Now, because it was actually Russia, not the USSR, now the agenda was more and more brazen and really more racially based. And this is where Dugin comes into his own here. And he's absolutely correct here. He says this: because the Russian Federation occupied the territory of the heartland, even if significantly shrunk, it still represents the land in the eyes of the Atlanticist geopolitical scientists. That is the enemy. And to finish off the enemy, it was necessary to push NATO deeper into Eurasia, and also to try to dismember Russia itself. We're talking about the first Chechen campaign, the wave of internal Russian separatism, etc. Russia will never be able to revive itself without Ukraine. End quote. And he is correct. I've said this a billion times, but Western liberalism sought nothing short of the total destruction of Russia as a concept. It's not a new Cold War, it's a new Crimean War. I mean, you know, I have a paper out on Brzezinski's The Grand Chessboard. And really, the only consistent aspect of that was the demand for the dissolution of Russia, at least in part, relative to Ukraine. The problem was, of course, that Ukraine was hardly anti-Russian. It certainly was anti-Soviet. You know, it didn't take much to be able to see that Western ideology led to the total meltdown of the Eastern European economy. Well, why did China do so well? China did well because it maintained its authoritarian presence on more national and less communist foundations after Mao's death in 76. So the media was called on in the West to invent this violently anti-Russian fifth column. So, you know, like Kosovo or Afghanistan, the point was not only to separate it from the heartland, but then to colonize it and hence destroying its very identity. So the regime went from this very poorly structured nationalism, which it doesn't even believe in, to just straight liberalism. That was the point of it. It's so rare that any intellectual of our ruling class understands what nationalism is, since everything usually is seen from the state's point of view. It's all they could see is a state or an individual. But this is the bizarre tension that's led to the Azov right sector in Ukraine. Groups like this, who under normal circumstances would be perfectly okay, but their violently anti-Russian tenor makes them very strange. To separate Ukraine from Russia or Tibet from China would be a massive victory, if not the victory for the regime. If it fails, then the war is over. This is why Eurasianism came into its own in the 1990s. The Soviets were gone. And really, according to Dugin, he's right, it was only in military circles that this conception maintained itself in any kind of detail. The Atlantic powers, based on liberalism, were violently pushing their cause, causing wars around the world to dislodge any concept of an independent Russia. Everything changed when Putin came to power. He restored, and I made my career on this concept, he restored Russian sovereignty. He destroyed the fifth column. Military, intelligence, the state itself, was the foundation for developing the strong, diverse economy it has today. It was a unified state, but not an empire. And Dugin's very clear that the last Chechen war, the creation of the federal districts, the focus on statehood, integration, this was Putin's agenda. This is why he's what he is. He's not the be-all and end-all of nationalism, but he laid the foundations for it. And I've said this 1,000 times. So Dugin says, and I'll end here, in short, Putin has returned Russia to the status of a subject of geopolitics, not its object. He consciously and responsibly joined the Great Continental War on behalf of the land power. End quote. Ukraine is a difference between empire and state in Russian history, and this is the foundation of his immense popularity. This is why you have this obsessive drive against Putin, while you had the obsessive drive against Russia during the Crimean era. The propaganda is identical. The West stops at nothing to install liberal governments in areas that, of course, become colonies of Washington. anyone buying the Russian aggression nonsense, it's the exact same nonsense that the British public was fed a century ago. Or a century, you know, a bit more than a century ago. Unfortunately, while Ukraine remains at the door of the Fourth World, the West has forced its military to expand, build hundreds of bases, import Western weapons, and all the rest. And all of this is at the expense of actual Ukrainian identity. This explains the Orange Revolution, it of 04, the Maidan Revolution of 14, and what provoked the present Russian military operation. Well, I didn't get to everything I wanted to talk about today, but I think you have the core of it all. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.